Okay, we're in the 23rd chapter of Luke, if you want to turn there. We've been going since October through Luke, and we've been looking at Jesus and his whole life, and mostly the 3 years of his, the last 3 years before he died on the cross. And so many of the things we've looked at, his continuing purpose and focus on seeking and saving the lost. And one thing that struck me is his courage in these different situations he finds himself in. It's just what a brave Lord we have. And then his love that he continues looking for opportunities to bring people and to him and to the Lord. And sometimes he was silent when people asked him questions. When he saw there was no reason to say anything, he was just silent about it. And other times, there are people who weren't interested in him, but he would speak because there were others in the room or around him that would hear the truth. And he always had that focus that, can I open a door for somebody to come to the truth? And so we're in chapter 23, and we've started to look at this horrible injustice that he's been dealing with, the cruel and the selfish people, the mob that was around him, that was inspired by the Jewish leadership, Judas, Herod, Pilate, to get to the end, this has just struck me of this injustice. But I have to remember, he's at the right hand of God. Everything has been made right, and those people who were just making his life miserable then, have been judged. And even when I say that, I think, you know, that wasn't Jesus' attitude. You know, not that, oh, great, they've been judged. It was, how can I bring people, even his enemies? That's what we found when we read Luke. Even his enemies, he was finding ways to attract them and bring the truth to him. So in chapter 23, he has been led to Pilate. Now he's gone through the trials, Annas, Caiaphas, the Sanhedrin, and they've determined he's going to die, and they need to get the Roman government to approve of this because they can't put him to death. They need Pilate to do it. So they've gone to him, and Pilate, we're going to see three times, says, he's not guilty. I find nothing there. And but the angry mob that's been stirred up by the religious leaders, you know, it just keeps getting worse. So down in verse 18 of chapter 23, and they all cried at once, saying, "Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain insurrection made in the city and for murder." So here, Pilate says, there's no evidence. And remember, Herod, too, he didn't find any evidence. But they are so dead set on destroying Jesus that they have decided, we'll release a murderer so that we can do this. verse 20, Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them. He knew. Verse 4, he said it. Verse 14, here. And then in another verse, verse 22, he's going to say it again. He's not guilty. Verse 21, but they shouted, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And so this frenzied mob has just really is really stirred up. And we're going to see soon what happens to this frenzied mob as these events unfold. Verse 22, and he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has he done? I found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chasten him and let him go." Well, that chastening is the scourging that would be done to someone before they're crucified, or just scourging without the crucifixion. And it is a horrible thing. It was tied around a post and crucified with, or scourged with a whip that had either pieces of nail or pottery shards or pieces of lead that would just tear open your back and mutilate you. And it seems like Pilate is thinking, if we can do this this mutilation and just have him come out and present himself to the crowds, they'll say, okay, that's enough. We're satisfied. And it seems like that's what Pilate is thinking. Will this satisfy this mob's bloodlust? In Acts chapter 13, or Acts chapter 3 and verse 13, here's Peter right after the kingdom is established, and he's preaching the second gospel sermon. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered up and denied in the presence of Pilate when he was determined to let him go. So here Peter is looking back at this and say, you know, Pilate wanted to let him go, but you insisted on it. So some of these people here are going to be there when Peter's preaching to them not many days from now. verse 23, but they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and the chief priest prevailed, so Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested. So these leaders and the mob, and they demanded and they prevailed, and Pilate, you know, Pilate was, you could see him, you put all the things he said together from all the gospel accounts, and he was impressed with Jesus. Now, he was a coward because it came right down to it, and at the end of it, he feared for himself and in answering to Rome or answering to the mob, and so he had him killed, you know. So he was a coward, but he is desperately trying to find a way out. Verse 26. Now, as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country. And on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. Cyrene is a city right on the north coast of Africa. So it's across the Mediterranean Sea from Greece. That's about where it is. And the Roman soldiers had that right, you know, to conscript a person, to grab someone off the street and say, you are my employee right now. Now you do this. And that's what was happening here. They just grabbed this guy who was probably coming over to the Passover, you know, at this time. And so he was in the area. And Jesus couldn't carry the cross. And it tells us something about how weak he was from the scourging that took place. We look at in Isaiah, some of the descriptions of that scourging and what he went through, and he was mutilated more than any man. And what does that mean? What did he look like? It just makes you shudder to think what he looked like at the time. But he was weak, and of course he hadn't slept all night. We saw that. He's been up all night going through these mock trials. Verse 27, and a great multitude of the people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. So here are probably these women that had traveled with him and supported him and others, and they were wailing in grief. They're watching their Lord being crucified. And in verse 28, but Jesus turning to them said, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. I compare that. He's before Herod, and he just doesn't say a thing, because Herod is only interested in do a miracle and amuse me. And he just doesn't even, he says nothing. But here he is completely worn out, mutilated, and he turns to these women who are wailing in grief, and he has these words of compassion for them. And I don't know what he looked like, and from the scriptures it would seem that he was unrecognizable as Jesus. I mean, he was just so mutilated. So verse 29, for indeed the days are coming in which they will say, Blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts which never nursed. Then they'll begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. That he's telling them there's a time coming here that you're going to feel so hopeless, you're ready to say stuff like this. I wish the mountains would fall on us and cover us up. Such turmoil was coming. And whether he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, or I think in this case, he's just talking also about here, Jesus, the Son of God, is on earth. And look what they're doing to him. What happens when the Son of God is not here? What's going to happen then? I mean, if you have God on earth, and this is what you do, and in fact, in the next verse, for if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? So he's preparing them for this time. That's and then verse 32, there were also two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. In Isaiah 53 and chapter 12, verse 12, it says, he was numbered with the transgressors. And in that verse, verse 12, the last part, it says, he was numbered with the transgressors, yet he himself bore the sins of many and interceded for the transgressors. So just the picture of him being led to the cross with sinners on either side, he's numbered with them. But what was really happening? He was bearing the sins of the transgressors. That's what really was happening. So it just that verse in Isaiah brings to mind what was really happening there. Verse 33, and when they had come to the place called Calvary, or Calvarium, which means a skull, it's also Golgotha, the place of the skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. So here is a place that in Israel, there is a place, it looks like a skull still. I mean, there's been 2,000 years of erosion, but it still has that look, and that's where they expect and think that's where he was crucified. And it is about a stone's throw from the crypt, and the crypt also where he was of Joseph of Arimathea, who gave his crypt, his burial place to Jesus. It's right there, and they think it is the actual one. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that supports that both those places are the actual place that it took place. And he was crucified. The word crucify, we get the word excruciating from that word. And it's just that idea of that the Romans had put together a system to torture and kill someone with the most amount of pain. And of course, when you go to the doctor and he says, what's your pain level, 1 or 10, or where in there? If you're saying 10, then that's excruciating. That's where that word comes from. Verse 34, then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And they divided his garments and cast lots. So here is this mutilated man hanging on a cross, surrounded by this unjust crowd and mob. And this is just one of those verses that is helpful to remember if you ever need to be reminded how much our Lord loves us. He's on the cross. He's barely recognizable, but his words are, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Jesus taught this forgiveness on the Sermon on the Mount. We saw that. Stephen, remember, he was being stoned at the end of his sermon, and he said the same thing, forgive them, as he was dying. Peter, in his sermon in Acts 2 and Acts 3, that first and second sermon in Jerusalem, was saying, you crucified him, but And then Paul actually says in 1 Corinthians 2:8, when he's referring to what they did, he said, had they known, they wouldn't have crucified him. So they didn't know what they were doing, but that's, you know, Jesus' attitude. Verse 35, and the people stood looking on, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, he saved others. Let him save himself if he's the Christ, the chosen of God. So it seems like at this point the people are looking on like they're starting to think, oh, what are we doing here? The rulers are still sneering and making fun and mocking him. The soldiers mocked him. Verse 36, and the soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine. And why that is mocking, I'm not sure, but it could be that if you give him a little something to drink, he's going to live a little longer and the pain goes longer. I'm not sure, but that's one the commentators said that could be the what was going on there. Verse 37, and saying, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself. An inscription also was written over him in letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. So this is the inscription that Pilate had put over Jesus. And he put, from the other Gospels, we know that they came to him and said, don't write that. Write that he said he was the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, I've written what I've written. And it seems like he's showing kind of contempt for this mob mentality here, and showing the Jews, I'll put what I'm going to put, and you're not going to change it. But at the same time, he's satisfying a rule from Rome that he had to show the inscription or show the crime on this inscription on the cross. Verse 39, then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, if you're the Christ, save yourself and us. So he says this mockingly, save us. And then verse 40, but the other answering rebuked him, saying, do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? So he the one criminal talks to the other one, don't you fear God? Now, in the other Gospels, we find both of them reviled the Lord. But now at this point, that one is starting to have second thoughts and saying, he's not guilty. We are. Don't you even fear God? And then verse 41, and we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. Verse 42, then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. So here's a man that had faith. In the midst of a frenzied mob, he's on a cross himself. Everyone there is shouting, crucify him. Now the crowds are starting to quiet down about this, but the leaders are trying to encourage it. But he has a level of faith here where he confessed it. He said he said these words and he asked, remember me. And then Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. So this is a verse that comes up sometimes when Jesus that people will say, hey, what about the thief on the cross? He wasn't baptized, so why is baptism so important? And so let's just take a quick look. I don't want to spend a lot of time, but here's a person that was saved. He went to paradise with Jesus without baptism. Well, what does baptism do? Well, it puts you into Christ. It puts you into his kingdom, into his church. That is the point that you enter it. And we ask ourselves, is the kingdom here yet? No, it's several weeks off yet before the kingdom is established on the day of Pentecost. So how was he saved? Well, the same way people were saved before the law of Moses. Remember, Abraham, before Moses, was saved by faith. or during the law of Abraham, David, during the law of Moses, saved by faith. And so he is saved by faith. And then when the kingdom came, then that baptism came in to where we're baptized into Christ and into the kingdom for the remission of sins. verse 44, and it was about the sixth hour. Okay, so this is from the morning. They're starting in the morning. So this is about noon, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. So here is a time when all of a sudden there's darkness for 3 hours, and we know that when the Passover was, it's on a lunar month, and it couldn't possibly be an eclipse. Some have tried to bring up, well, maybe there was an eclipse then. Well, no, there was. It couldn't have been at the time. But what? You got the crowds here that they're looking on. They're no longer shouting. They're looking on. And now darkness comes. And I suppose it got very quiet and silent. And what is going on here? And as we look at the other Gospels, it tells us there was darkness, there were earthquakes, and the graves were open. And you think about those three things. First of all, darkness. What's going on there? It's like all of a sudden, God on earth is about ready to die. This is what happens when God leaves the earth. Darkness. Earthquakes. If you've been in one, you know that feeling. I was in one, I guess it's around 20 years ago now, that we had a pretty good sized one here. And I was on a concrete floor, and that concrete floor turned to liquid. It was so strange to be like you were surfing on. It didn't make sense. And it was like even gravity and the ground is not safe. And that's the feeling I got at the time is, wow, that these real basic things that give us stability are gone with an earthquake. And then the graves being opened, not even death. You know, death is not the end. So we're taking three things that were just shocking. And these three things happened. verse 45, then the sun was darkened, the veil of the temple was torn in two, and when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. So here this, I'm sure there were probably some priests in the temple when this happens. It's dark, and the veil tears from the top to the bottom. And what is the veil? It's the part that separates us from God, because we're sinners and we can't go into the Holy of Holies. We have to send the high priest just once a year to go, not without blood, to present themselves before God. But now, at this moment, Jesus is dying and the price is being paid. So sinners can come before God because they're relying on Jesus to forgive them their sins. And so this event, I just wrote on the side here on verse 45 and 46, this is the point in all time, period. I don't know what else to add to that. It is the point in all time. It's the, whether you go all the way back to the creation of the world, what's the purpose of that? And all through Abraham, the patriarchs, the Old Testament law, they're all looking forward to the Messiah coming and paying for their sins and having salvation. And then everyone after that, till now and on, are looking back to that point. It is the point in time. And let's see, verse 47, and when the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, certainly this was a righteous man. Or some of your translations, certainly this was the Son of God. So here's a centurion. He's a guy that is a soldier over 100 soldiers, He's been in wars, he's seen death, and he sees this. He's never seen anything like this. He's seen Jesus speak to the criminals that he's being crucified with. He's seen him speak to his enemies, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. He's prayed to God while he's on the cross. He is, the way he accepts death, he's been there when it got dark for 3 hours. This centurion is a battle-hardened soldier, and he says, this was the Son of God. Verse 48, and the whole crowd who came together to that sight, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned. So here is that reaction of this crowd that had become a little more quiet a little earlier, but now, after this darkness and what they've seen, they're beating their breast. It's like that Luke 18, the tax man who felt he was a sinner, and he just, what have I done? And he, that symbol of contriteness and shame, really, to hit yourself on your chest and say, what have I done? And that's what these are feeling. What have I done? They're struck by it. They're humbled by it, and they're numbed. That's what I guess the word I would say is they feel numb about what have we done. Verse 49, but all his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. So, verse 50, and behold, there was a man named Joseph, a council member, so he's on the Sanhedrin, a good and just man. We find out from John that he disagreed with what was happening to Jesus. But he did it secretly because he's in this council of 71, and there's another guy that's like that. It's Nicodemus, too. We'll hear about him, too. But he's on this council. He had not consented to their council, indeed. He was from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who himself was also waiting for the kingdom of God. So here he is, verse 52, this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. When he took it down, wrapped it in linen, and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of rock where no one had ever lain before. So this is from a town kind of on the border between Judea and Samaria. And he's been secret about his support of Jesus, but he gets some courage, and probably after seeing what he saw, and he goes and asks for the body of Jesus. And verse 53, took it down, wrapped it in linen, laid in a tomb that was hewn out of rock where no one had lain before. And that day was the preparation, and Sabbath drew near. So here it is, it's Friday evening. Saturday is the Sabbath. And remember, we're on the Roman or the Jewish clock. So 6 o'clock in the evening, it's going to change to Saturday, the Sabbath. It's about 3 o'clock now. That a little after 3 is probably when Jesus actually died, and he takes the body, and he takes it to this tomb, and there's 3 hours left before you've got to back off. It's the Sabbath. You don't touch a dead body. You rest. You do no more work. Verse 55, and the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. So here is the women from Galilee. These had been following, had been supporting Jesus in many ways. They observed it. They're at the tomb. They're observing this. And then they returned home, and they prepared spices and oils. And in John 19, we find, too, that Nicodemus brought 100 pounds of spices. But here, they have gone home. They haven't taken them. They've left and gone home, prepared these. And then we move to chapter 24. Now, on the first day of the week, okay, that's Sunday now. So you've had an entire Sabbath where they rested. Right before the Sabbath, they put those spices, they started to prepare them but they're getting ready to bring it on Sunday morning. Now it seems like, as we look at Nicodemus, he had gone with Joseph to the tomb with the 100 pounds of spices. But these women were going to bring some and kind of finish the embalming on the first day of the week. On the first day of the week, early in the morning, they and certain other women with them came to the tomb bringing the spices which they had prepared. So this is early. It was still, one of the Gospels tells it was still dark, just starting to get light. And they, these women from Galilee and some other women, are coming to complete this embalming. Verse 2, but they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. So, and most of us are familiar, there's a hole in the rock and a round stone 3 to 4 feet high that's maybe this thick and that is rolled over the past the door to close it. And so they found this stone rolled open, so it's open now. And they went in, did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. So here these are the first ones to see the empty tomb. And it happened as they were greatly perplexed about this, that behold, two men stood by them in shining garments. Then as they were afraid and bowed their heads, that's the usual reaction to angels, which these are, bowed their faces to the earth and said to them, why do you seek the living among the dead? So they are perplexed. They're puzzled and confused. They don't know how do we make sense of this? One of the descriptions of the people's faces, these angels' faces, was lightning. It is so bright, and then dazzling clothing, shining garments. The guards, both of them, are laying on the ground as if they're dead, and the stone is rolled away. So that's what they find when they get there. And they were afraid. And of course, the angels question, why do you seek the living among the dead? And he is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spoke to you when he was in Galilee? And in Luke 9, we saw that. He already told them this exact thing, that he will die and he will be raised after 3 days. So it's just that can't get through our minds. It couldn't get through their minds that there was actually going to be that Jesus would go through this. They never really grasped that. Verse 7, saying, the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and the third day rise again. So he repeats what he already told them in Luke 9:22. And they remembered his words. So now they're putting this together. Then they returned from the tomb, that these women, and told all the things to the 11 and to all the rest. So there were the 11 and another group of people that were with them. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. And their words seemed to them like idle tales, and they did not believe them. So even these women, they are going to be great witnesses. They are already. They've witnessed the crucifixion. They've witnessed the burial. They saw the angels. They saw the empty tomb. And pretty soon, they're going to see the resurrection. So they're seeing all these things and are eyewitnesses to these things. And so when they told these 11 and that group that was with them, they knew what Jesus had said, but they were skeptics. And that's the best kind of witness to have, isn't it? A skeptic. If you find someone that's skeptic and they come with news and, oh, I never believed this, but man, when I saw this, I'm a believer. That's a lot. That holds a lot more. Is a stronger evidence. And then verse 12. But Peter arose and ran to the tomb, and stooping down, he saw the linen cloths lying by themselves, and he departed, marveling to himself at what had happened. So here Peter says, "I'm going to go see this for myself." And So that's where we'll wrap it up today. I know 2 weeks ago I said I was going to bring a timeline, and I haven't done that because of time. And I'm going to try, I think, because I'm into 24 far enough, I think I can bring that timeline next time, and we'll talk about that. Because just to see what happened on Friday, what time of the day, what happened on Saturday, and what when on Sunday did all these things happen, it's kind of good to put all those things together. So I'll try to bring some kind of chart to look at that next week. Okay.